The following Monday afternoon, Jim and I climbed the steep front steps to Mrs. DeBose's house and padded down the open hallway. Jim, armed with Ivanhoe and full of superior knowledge, knocked at the second door on the left. "Mrs. DeBose," he called. Jesse opened the wood door and unlatched the screen door. "Is that you, Jim Finch?" she said. "You got your sister with you? I don't know." "Let 'em both in, Jesse," said Mrs. DeBose. Jesse admitted us and went off to the kitchen. An oppressive odor met us when we crossed the threshold, an odor I had met many times in rain-rotted gray houses where there are coal oil lamps, water dippers, and unbleached domestic sheets. It always made me afraid, expectant, watchful. In the corner of the room was a brass bed, and in the bed was Mrs. DeBose. I wondered if Jim's activities had put her there, and for a moment I felt sorry for her. She was lying under a pile of quilts and looked almost friendly. There was a marble-topped washstand by her bed. On it were a glass with a teaspoon in it, a red ear syringe, a box of absorbent cotton, and a steel alarm clock standing on three tiny legs. "So you brought that dirty little sister of yours, did you?" was her greeting. Jim said quietly, "My sister ain't dirty, and I ain't scared of you," although I noticed his knees shaking. I was expecting a tirade, but all she said was, "You may commence reading, Jeremy." Jim sat down in a cane-bottomed chair and opened Ivanhoe. I pulled up another one and sat beside him. "Come closer," said Mrs. DeBose. "Come to the side of the bed." We moved our chairs forward. This was the nearest I had ever been to her, and the thing I wanted most to do was move my chair back again. She was horrible. Her face was the color of a dirty pillowcase, and the corners of her mouth glistened with wet, which inched like a glacier down the deep grooves enclosing her chin. Old age liver spots dotted her cheeks, and her pale eyes had black pinpoint pupils. Her hands were knobby, and the cuticles were grown up over her fingernails. Her bottom plate was not in, and her upper lip protruded. From time to time, she would draw her nether lip to her upper plate and carry her chin with it. This made the wet move faster. I didn't look any more than I had to. Jim reopened Ivanhoe and began reading. I tried to keep up with him, but he read too fast. When Jim came to a word he didn't know, he skipped it, but Mrs. DeBose would catch him and make him spell it out. Jim read for perhaps 20 minutes, during which time I looked at the soot-stained mantelpiece, out the window, anywhere to keep from looking at her. As he read along, I noticed that Mrs. DeBose's corrections grew fewer and farther between, that Jim had even left one sentence dangling in midair. She was not listening. I looked toward the bed. Something had happened to her. She lay on her back, with the quilts up to her chin. Only her head and shoulders were visible. Her head moved slowly from side to side. From time to time, she would open her mouth wide, and I could see her tongue undulate faintly. Cords of saliva would collect on her lips. She would draw them in, then open her mouth again. Her mouth seemed to have a private existence of its own. It worked separate and apart from the rest of her, out and in, like a clam hole at low tide. Occasionally it would say, "Pfft," like some vicious substance coming to a boil. I pulled Jim's sleeve. He looked at me, then at the bed. Her head made its regular sweep toward us, and Jim said, "Mrs. DeBose, are you all right?" She did not hear him. The alarm clock went off and scared us stiff. A minute later, nerves still tingling, Jim and I were on the sidewalk headed for home. We did not run away. Jesse sent us. Before the clock wound down, She was in the room, pushing Jim and me out of it. "Shoo," she said. "You all go home." Jim hesitated at the door. "It's time for her medicine," Jesse said. As the door swung shut behind us, I saw Jesse walking quickly toward Mrs. DeBose's bed. It was only 3:45 when we got home, so Jim and I drop-kicked in the backyard until it was time to meet Atticus. Atticus had 2 yellow pencils for me and a football magazine for Jim, which I suppose was a silent reward for our first day's session with Mrs. DeBose. Jim told him what happened. "Did she frighten you?" asked Atticus. "No, sir," said Jim. "But she's so nasty. She has fits or something. She spits a lot." "She can't help that. When people are sick, they don't look nice sometimes." "She scared me," I said. Atticus looked at me over his glasses. "You don't have to go with Jim, you know." The next afternoon at Mrs. DeBose's was the same as the first, and so was the next, until gradually a pattern emerged. Everything would begin normally. That is, Mrs. DeBose would hound Jim for a while on her favorite subjects, her camellias and our father's nigger-loving propensities. She would grow increasingly silent, then go away from us. The alarm clock would ring, Jesse would shoo us out, and the rest of the day was ours. "Atticus," I said one evening, "what exactly is a nigger lover?" Atticus's face was grave. "Has somebody been calling you that?" "No, sir. Mrs. DeBose calls you that. She warms up every afternoon calling you that. Francis called me that last Christmas. That's where I first heard it." "Is that the reason you jumped on him?" asked Atticus. "Yes, sir." "Then why are you asking me what it means?" I tried to explain to Atticus that it wasn't so much what Francis said that had infuriated me as the way he had said it. It was like he'd said snot nose or something. "Scout," said Atticus, "nigger lover is just one of those terms that don't mean anything, like snot nose. It's hard to explain. Ignorant, trashy people use it when they think somebody's favoring Negroes over and above themselves. It's slipped into usage with some people like ourselves when they want a common, ugly term to label somebody." "You aren't really a nigger lover then, are you?" "I certainly am. I do my best to love everybody. I'm hard put sometimes. Baby, it's never an insult to be called what somebody thinks is a bad name. It just shows you how poor that person is. It doesn't hurt you. So don't let Mrs. DeBose get you down. She has enough troubles of her own." One afternoon, a month later, Jim was plowing his way through Sir Walter Scout, as Jim called him, and Mrs. DeBose was correcting him at every turn when there was a knock on the door. "Come in!" she screamed. Atticus came in. He went to the bed and took Mrs. DeBose's hand. "I was coming from the office and didn't see the children," he said. "I thought they might still be here." Mrs. DeBose smiled at him. For the life of me, I could not figure out how she could bring herself to speak to him when she seemed to hate him so. "Do you know what time it is, Atticus?" she said. "Exactly 5:14. The alarm clock's set for 5:30. I want you to know that." It suddenly came to me that each day we had been staying a little longer at Mrs. DeBose's, that the alarm clock went off a few minutes later every day, and that she was well into one of her fits by the time it sounded. Today she had antagonized Jim for nearly 2 hours with no intention of having a fit, and I felt hopelessly trapped. The alarm clock was the signal for our release. If one day it did not ring, what would we do? I have a feeling that Jim's reading days are numbered, said Atticus. Only a week longer, I think, she said, just to make sure. Jim rose, but Atticus put out his hand and Jim was silent. On the way home, Jim said he had to do it just for a month, and the month was up, and it wasn't fair.
Just one more week, son, said Atticus.
No, said Jim.
Yes, said Atticus.
The following week found us back at Mrs. DeBose's. The alarm clock had ceased sounding, but Mrs. DeBose would release us with, "That'll do." So late in the afternoon, Atticus would be home reading the paper when we returned. Although her fits had passed off, she was in every other way her old self. When Sir Walter Scott became involved in lengthy descriptions of moats and castles, Mrs. DeBose would become bored and pick on us. "Jeremy Fitch, I told you you lived to regret tearing up my camellias. You regret it now, don't you?" Jim would say he certainly did. "Thought you could kill my snow on the mountain, did you? Well, Jesse says the top's growing back out. Next time you'll know how to do it right, won't you? You'll pull it up by the roots, won't you?" Jim would say he certainly would. "Don't you mutter at me, boy. You hold up your head and say, 'Yes, ma'am.' Don't guess you feel like holding it up, though, with your father what he is." Jim's chin would come up, and he would gaze at Mrs. DeBose with a face devoid of resentment. Through the weeks, he had cultivated an expression of polite and detached interest, which he would present to her in answer to her most blood-curdling inventions. At last the day came when Mrs. DeBose said, "That'll do." One afternoon, she added, "And that's all. Good day to you." It was over. We bounded down the sidewalk on a spree of sheer relief, leaping and howling.